Welcome to the Nothing is Wasted podcast, conversations designed to help you as you live, learn, and lead through pain. And now, the host of the Nothing is Wasted podcast, Davey Blackburn.
Hello, welcome to the Nothing is Wasted podcast. I'm Davey, your host. Joining me, Aubrey, our co-host.
Hello.
Aubrey, we have an interesting conversation with a firefighter, a former firefighter.
Yeah.
Jason Sawtell. And this conversation got my wheels turning a little bit. And I'll tell you why. This is the first time I've transitioned from being a local church pastor to kind of now leading a ministry that works with people who are in pain and trauma all the time. And
right.
Jason mentioned something, and we have some conversation around this, about when you're on the front lines of ministry, specifically dealing with pain and trauma, like counseling or something like that, or you're on the front lines of kind of first responding, you're constantly inundated with responding to other people's trauma, absorbing that, taking that on, and it can do some detrimental things to your own soul if you don't care for it in a very strategic way. And it caused me to like start asking questions like, what do counselors do to like cope with or manage kind of dealing with everybody else's trauma and pain all the time?
I was actually just, it's funny that you say that. I was just on a phone call this morning with a really good friend of mine who's a therapist. And she was kind of talking about this same thing, how she feels like, I won't say her name obviously, but she feels like she is kind of holding some low-grade depression and anxiety at bay right now because she's hearing so many people's stories, especially during the pandemic season and the downfall of the economy.
Yeah.
She's hearing and carrying so many stories of pain and depression and darkness.
Yeah.
And so I was asking her, what do you do? How do you kind of cope? And she was saying, she does yoga, I pray, I go on walks. And then she'll just even turn on like a funny novel to listen to, something that's just kind of shallow in a sense, so she can like decompress and then walk into her home and still be a mom and still be a wife and re-engage with life that is right in front of her.
Yeah, it's almost like trying to find these little pockets of escape. You know, Christy and I talk about this when it comes to ministry, that there one of the roads that you don't want to go down when you're serving people, helping people, is a road of escapism. Right? We don't want to go into the unhealthy, I've got to get away from here. And so, I mean, I've heard pastors and, you know, ministry leaders who have talked about their struggle with escapism, that it was so bad that they would try to strategize how to self-sabotage because they just wanted
just
to
so
get out of the pressure, get out of the...
Didn't want to be in ministry anymore.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so there's like, you know, in their right mind, that's not what they want to do. They're called to this. They love it.
Right.
They're satisfied by it. They're fulfilled by helping and serving people. But it can become so heavy that if you don't, I believe, create small pockets of escape to get out from under it, you're going to slip into this like escapism mentality where you're constantly looking to get away from it.
Yeah, or constantly numbing, constantly avoiding, constantly making those, you get into addictive behaviors at that point.
Yeah,
but almost intentionally because you're trying to get, like you said, get away from it.
And that seems so, it seems crazy when you just think about it, like someone would want to self-sabotage.
Right.
It's like, wait, what? But it is, it's more prevalent than what you think.
Yeah.
It really is.
I know for me when I'm, you know, because we've talked about before on the podcast that I'm a big feeler.
Yeah.
So sometimes when in ministry we're ministering to people who have gone through a lot of trauma, or it's just been one of those weeks where someone, you know, was dealing with trauma and then the next person was, and then we've had a house call because of domestic violence, or, you know, it's just sometimes it gets very heavy. And it can be hard for me to kind of step away and remove myself emotionally. I'll have to like almost imagine all of the pain and the sorrow on a plate. Sounds kind of funny, but like it's on a plate. It's all piled up together, almost like mixed spaghetti noodles or something. And I'll close my eyes and I'll be like, okay, Lord, I feel like I'm carrying all of this right now. Is there a thread here that you want to pull on that we can kind of, you can help me sort of process through and let go of? Like, Holy Spirit, is there something you have to say? And
good.
Sometimes I'll just spend 20, 30 minutes like, here's my plate, God, take the emotions in. And sometimes the Lord will just literally, like, I'll sort of envision, you know, him pulling on a thread. Mm. Hey, I've got this one, Aubrey. You don't have to worry about it. Or let me show you something I'm doing here about it. And for whatever reason, it helps me just to, like, hand over the plate, yeah, as silly as that sounds, and then walk away. And then, you know, it comes up again, but yeah. I can remember, like, the Lord has my spaghetti noodles of other people's trauma because I can't carry it right now.
That's so good. That's so good. I remember specifically right after Amanda passed away and I started, you know, going and speaking and hearing other people's pain stories all the time. I remember just going, Lord, I can't absorb all this. I can't carry all of this.
Too much.
And the Lord was like, I didn't call you to carry it.
Mm.
I called you to deflect it. I want you to take other people's pain. I want you to deflect it onto me. And so that really, that visual just kind of helped change my perspective on that. And I think that people who are, you know, everybody has a different propensity for that. You are obviously a big feeler. So you're going to, and that's one of your superpowers is that you're able to really sit in with people and empathize with people and minister to people in that way. But then the danger of that's going to be that you carry those, you'd be susceptible to carry those things. Whereas other people, you know, like my wife, she is so good at intense situations because she's so almost detached emotionally from it that she gives really clear-headed guidance and coaching matter-of-factly sometimes. And it's exactly what people need, you know?
Yeah, almost, and like, so, these are the next steps you need to take, or because she can step back from it. Yeah,
exactly,
that's so good.
Exactly. So we've had to like create some boundaries even around, because I want to like process through a lot of stuff with her on like date night or something. And she's like, listen, date night's not, it's time for fun. It's a little
date
escape
night is fun
thing.
Night.
We're going to, you know, and so same thing with like vacations. Like we're, you know, for me, I'm like, this is a good time to decompress and to like process through these things. And we're like, no. Vacation's not for that. So typically I have to take like 2 days almost in my kind of get in my reserve self, you know, and like read an escape novel for the first 2 days.
Right.
And then it's like, okay, cool. I can just kind of, after that, I can kind of engage with Christy and adventure, and we can really truly kind of step away from
like retrain your brain and your soul and your spirit. Like, okay, now I'm here right now.
I'm present with her and I'm not thinking about all of this, the ministry to-dos and the pain that we're helping people navigate and all of that stuff. Yeah,
that seems really healthy and good.
Here's what we'd like to do. Why don't we hear from our listeners?
Oh, such a good idea.
I would love, and you know, I'm going to qualify a few things, you know, but you can share with us no matter who you are, what you do, but particularly I'd love to hear from folks who are on kind of like frontline ministries. So counselors, or, you know, you're in ministries where you're dealing with people's trauma, your care pastor, something like that. You're kind of absorbing other people's trauma all the time, or you're a first responder, you're dealing in the medical field or whatever it is that you're constantly assessing and addressing other people's trauma. What do you do? We'd love to hear from you what you do strategies to cope in a healthy way with
absorbing. Yeah, I think that's a great idea. That would help us actually, right? So we can learn how do you not distance yourself emotionally, but what healthy steps do you take to take on people's trauma, but then sort of decompress and get back to the life that God has for you.
Right. So here's what you can do to feed that back to us. Go to Instagram, take to Instagram and share it in a story or a post and tag Nothing Is Wasted Ministries. Just make sure you tag Nothing Is Wasted Ministries. We'll share it. We'll kind of help other people with some of these strategies as well, because I'm sure people are asking the same questions.
Yeah, this will be really good. I think that Jason's story will inspire a lot of those. So I'm looking forward to seeing what shows up and what we can share.
Yeah.
I do want to say this. Jason's story is intense. Mm-hmm. And some of the content that he brings up is around a lot of heavy emotions, specifically around suicide. So there may be a trigger warning for you. We just want to say that.
Yeah.
I also want to just mention the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. If you are struggling with any feelings or thoughts or plans around suicide, or you're with someone who is, you can call this number any time of day or night, 1-800-273-8255. I have actually had to call the number before sitting with a suicidal person, and it is an incredibly helpful resource.
Wow.
So again, that's 1-800-273-8255.
Wow. Well, Jason's book just released this month. It's called The Rescuer. One firefighter's story of courage, darkness, and the relentless love that saved him. He's going to talk about a lot of different things, some of which are in this book and some of which are not in this book. We were privy to some stuff that he did not include in this book, in this conversation. So let's go ahead and listen in to my conversation with Jason Sawtell. Jason, it's so great to have you on the podcast with me. Thanks for joining me.
Oh, man, it's such a blessing to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Man, you have just released this book called The Rescuer, and the listener doesn't know this because they can't see you right now, but you've got a massive firefighter coat hanging up in the background with your your last name, and this is much of your story as a firefighter. That's all I know about you. That's all our listeners know about you right now. And so I'd love to find out some more about you. I'm excited about this conversation. Why don't you, before we kind of go back and talk about your story, why don't you just tell us a little bit about your life right now? Tell us about your family, where you guys live, what you do for a living, all of that.
Yeah, definitely. First off, it was about 5 years ago, I was actually injured on the job and had to leave the fire department, which was kind of tough because it's all that I knew from the age of 18 until 5 years ago. And as much as that hurt, it was one of the worst days of my life, but it's also, looking back upon it, one of the best days of my life.
Yeah.
So that is the last 5 years. I have actually moved over into training, where I'll train young paramedics and different nurses, things like that. But my heart was really kind of geared towards doing something else, because that's more hands-on, which is a total blessing to do. But I started speaking at men's retreats, started speaking at churches, kind of telling the different stories that I had. And people asked me, man, you need to write a book. Well, I dropped out of high school in the 10th grade, so writing a book was the last thing on my mind.
Yeah.
Wow. But I look at it more as like a ministry. So where I am now is my family and I, we live just above Sacramento, kind of in the foothills, and right below Lake Tahoe, a little bit out of the heat, but we're still not up in the snow line, which is really cool.
Yeah.
We have two younger children, which is Isaac and Noah. Noah's 12, Isaac is 14. And then we also have two older children, Beth and Alex, who we adopted. Bethany was 16 when she came to live with us.
Okay.
And Alex was, well, actually she was 15. And then Alex was 7. And that was, oh gosh, what, 14 years ago now that they came to live with us. So they're older and they've moved out of the house. And it was quite the experience, because we had an infant plus a 15-year-old plus another child, and they came from really, really tough circumstances, because they're my niece and nephew, and we just had some really rough things going on in our family. And we had a knock at the door one day, and CPS said, hey, this is your niece and nephew, and you got a few minutes to decide if you'd like to take them in or they're going into the system. And Christy and I were just been married for 2 years, had a brand new baby, so we went from a party of two to a party of three. And then a few days later, we went to a party of five.
Wow.
And then shortly thereafter, she's pregnant again, we became a party of six. And as hard as it was, it's just been such a blessing though.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. I can't imagine that kind of a transition that drastically, and how it really just not only upended your life, but also shaped you guys quite a bit, I'm sure. Yeah,
definitely. The early years were really tough, because I would come home from a 48-hour shift at the firehouse, and you would take a literal physical beating there sometimes by going to all the medicals, all the fires, not catching rest. Come home, and she would head off to work. She's a labor and delivery nurse. And so no sooner would I walk through the door, she'd hand me a child. She'd hand me homework. She'd hand me an angry 15-year-old girl, and off she went. Off she went.
Wow.
And it was just so hard, because the balancing of, I hadn't even debriefed from pouring into other people and helping out all the traumas that we deal with over as a firefighter in West Oakland, to now walking into this. And it's just those trials that just helped me grow in the Lord so much, and kind of prepared me for even writing the book, even though all these stories aren't in the book, because the book's more about my conversion 18 years ago.
Yeah.
But all the stuff I experienced, and seeing how stories of the pain and suffering that you go through, you can actually use for the good of others. And that's kind of, I let it drive me to write the book too.
Wow. That's incredible. That's exactly what our podcast is all about. Obviously, the Nothing Is Wasted podcast, that we all undergo trauma and pain and suffering of varying degrees, but God wants to use those. He wants to turn those around for good, for our good, and for the blessing of other people. And so I know that this book is going to be, it already is a blessing to so many people, but why don't you kind of take us back and talk a little bit about the storyline of, you know, the journey that you've been on and the inspiration behind this book?
Yeah, definitely. So where it kind of begins is explaining my past is I was a young child around 7 or 8 when my parents divorced. And my mom, who was kind of like my security blanket, she moved 500 miles away to move away from my dad for reasons that I can kind of understand now. But at the time, I didn't understand. And I was left to stay with my dad. And my dad is a wonderful, amazing man. But during that time of his life, he was struggling with being out of the Vietnam War, being newly divorced, having demons of his past. I don't even know what they were. And unfortunately, as a child, he kind of took them out on me. And so my childhood was super, super rough. And going to school, I didn't connect with people because I didn't dress like everyone else because they all had good clothes. I had dirty, stinky clothes. Other kids would get school lunches. I couldn't get a school lunch because if I asked my dad for the money, it was basically just easier for me to keep it quiet, go hungry instead of dealing with the repercussions of always asking him for stuff because he didn't like me to ask him for a whole lot. So at the age of about 15, 16-ish, when I was in 10th grade, I finally just separated from school. I was done because there was no support. There's nothing going on. They couldn't understand why I wasn't turning in my homework. They didn't understand why I couldn't concentrate. And they were basically tough on me. And finally, I just had it up to here. And I said, I'm leaving school now. And that's when I didn't get in like a whole lot of trouble, but I could see my life was going in a direction it probably shouldn't. Yeah. So I joined the California Conservation Corps and started working there. And we were at a fire camp one time helping feed the firefighters there. And all of a sudden it just kind of hit me like, wow, being a firefighter would be a really cool job. So I go and I talk to one of the guys and like, oh yeah, you need a high school diploma. Like, oh, okay, well I'm out now. So I went back and I took my high school proficiency exam, which is kind of like a GED, but it actually gave me my diploma because it proves that I knew everything that I needed to graduate. So I got that and I joined the California Department of Forestry, and we were on another fire. It was back in 1993 during all the firestorms. And my captain, I remember he was saying, do you know what all those city firemen make? I'm like, no, what? And he's like, $50,000 a year. And I'm like, I'm making $425 an hour. No way. So I'm going to go be a city fireman. And then everything just kind of progressed where I went to paramedic school then, became a Alameda County paramedic, and then shortly thereafter joined the Oakland Fire Department. So that was in the late 90s.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wow. Yeah. So that's kind of the backstory of where I was prior to starting the fire department, where the book kind of picks up.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, you finally take all these progressions, you finally get into this place where you're doing this thing that looked like it was, hey, this is what I want to do. This looks awesome. Mm-hmm. And yet I'm wondering, was there still some unrest? What kind of led to you, finally having a relationship with Jesus and your conversion experience? What kind of led up to that?
Yeah, so much led up to it, you know, especially when after the fact, I always say you put your spiritual or scriptural goggles on to look into your past and you start noticing all these things, you know, like, whoa, he's actually been calling me at the age of 5 and here, and
that's
he starts
so
seeing
true.
It.
That's so true. You can't recognize it during the moment when you're in the weeds, but you can kind of look back and you can see the providential hand of God all throughout wooing you into a relationship. That's great.
Right. Until something becomes your truth, it's just a lie when you look at it. So why would you recognize something back then when I was bathed in the Holy Spirit to understand that this is what was happening, you know? So anyways, working as an Oakland firefighter, the greatest job on the face of the earth. I'm telling you, to be able to work in an area where you're blessed to serve others, it actually made me feel good because I never felt good growing up. And now I had a job that made me feel good. And it didn't make me feel good seeing other people hurt. It made me feel good that I could show up and provide care to them.
Yeah.
But the issue was, is I was providing care to people. I would be like, okay, my sad past is kind of away, but I had an emptiness inside of me. And as soon as we would head back to the firehouse or I'd go home, what I felt was good from that call would go away. The emptiness inside me would eat it up.
Mm.
So I was like, okay, we'd go on another call. All right, I feel good again. And then it ate it up. And basically what I was doing was throwing everything that this world said would make me feel better. Money, helping other people, doing this other stuff, going on vacation with the guys, hanging out. I threw it all at this emptiness inside of me. And it ate it alive and actually made the hole bigger. So I kind of explained it like a black hole.
Mm.
And finally, after responding to so much pain and trauma and the hurt, I couldn't take it anymore. Mm. And I'm more than happy in a few minutes kind of discuss some of those calls with you.
Yeah, so, keep going. And then I want to circle back to that for sure.
For sure. And so one day after a really tough call on the Bay Bridge of watching a suicidal jumper leap, and I was talking to him and I really didn't expect him to go. When he stepped back and took that, as I'd say, the eternal plunge, I saw something in his eyes, and it wasn't like I saw something like, you know, a devilish or a real figure there, but his eyes were just empty, man. And it was like I could see that he didn't want to go, but it was like something was pulling him and making him go, and he went. And I recognize that inside of me also.
Wow.
And I started to think, man, all this stuff that I've gone through that I thought I could rescue myself from, I couldn't. Mm. And so I basically became that jumper on the Bay Bridge because I recognized what he's going through. And things were going tough, and I had a few more tough days at work. And I remember I was at home just being tormented. I couldn't sleep. I was hurting. Bad things were inside me. And there was a little church down the street from my house. Mm. And I remember seeing people go there. And I lived in a really cool area in Northern California called Santa Rosa, which is old school houses, really cool downtown, college type town. Yeah. So a lot of people would walk past my house. And as they were going to this little church, I always saw them happy. And it dawned on me, I'm like, you know what? My dad told me to not like church people. He used to call them stupid church people. And so during my high school years, I was actually really tough on Christians. I'd make fun of them. I'd berate them. And even as a firefighter, there's a story where a pastor came by our firehouse and I told him to get out. I called him a coward and I yelled at him when he was actually there to care for me. So I was really a messed up guy, but something was calling me to that church. So I put on my best pair of board shorts and my best shirt, and I go up because I do quite a bit of surfing and stuff. So I go over to the church, and they get ready to walk in. The two greeters put their hands up, and they said, no, you can't come in dressed like that. Wow. And, dude, it crushed me to my soul. I mean, because my whole life, I never got to participate in PE because I didn't have a PE uniform. And so the coaches would make fun of me. And so it all came back, and I'm thinking in my mind, I have a badge in my wallet that says Oakland Firefighter. I would run into that church, even though these guys treated me like a jerk, and rescue anyone in there and do mouth to mouth on them. But I didn't say that. I just looked at him. I was like, I walked off, and I had tears in my eyes, and I was just like, done, because I wanted the happiness they had. But once again, I was turned away to the darkness.
Yeah.
And that's when all of a sudden, whatever it was that was eating me up inside, it felt like it left. And it's not like it got better. It actually freaked me out because I was like, I'm done. I'm going to kill myself. The finality was there. And wow. I didn't feel scared. It felt like this was now my best option. So I go home and make out the plan. And that was it. I was ready to be done. And as I'm getting ready to follow through on the plan of the point of no return, my good friend from the San Francisco Fire Department, who's one of those guys that never takes no for an answer, like, we're going to breakfast. You're like, dude, I've got something. And he's at your front door and you're going to breakfast. He's one of those guys, right?
Yeah.
And he's an atheist too. He shows up to my front door and he just looked in my eyes because as firefighters, we're always evaluating scenes. We're always treating people. I look everyone. I think, wow, what are they going through? And I'm trying to treat the scene. And he looked at me, he's all, whoa. I'm like, what? He's all, looks around, he's like, we're going to breakfast.
Mm.
And just that moment of him taking me to breakfast turned it around. And I started realizing, well, maybe there is something to live for.
Wow.
And what the craziness out of that story is, I went to a church looking for help and actually had to walk away ready to kill myself. And an atheist showed up and helped save my life.
Wow.
Now, what I use that story is because I don't want to beat down churches and I don't want to get into the legalistic side of my feelings about all of that. But what I do is I look at myself in the mirror when I think about that story and say, are you doing anything like that to anyone? Are you turning them away? Are your actions, are the way you're presenting yourself, are the way you're looking or judging them, making them feel uncomfortable where they don't want or they can't see the light of the Lord shining out of me? And so that's what I use it as opposed to saying, oh, churches are bad and old legalistic suit and tie churches are bad. No, I'm not going to say that.
Yeah.
But I'm going to use it to make sure that I do the right thing to help others.
Wow. That's so good. So good, Jason. Let's circle back on some of the pain and trauma of the things that you were responding to and how that began taking a toll on you. Cause I can imagine, especially as someone at the time who, you know, you didn't have the power of the Holy Spirit inside of you. And so you didn't have that supernatural ability to carry other people's burdens. You know, you're carrying it yourself. And so I can only imagine all the different scenes that you're seeing and how it's beginning to just wear on you day in, day out, especially knowing kind of the outlook that you had on life up to that point. So talk to us a little bit about that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, looking at it again with my scriptural goggles on, looking back, is I was trying to do good.
Yeah.
But if you really think about it, it was in a self-worshipping sort of way because I was trying to make myself feel better by doing good for them, as opposed to the simple recognition that all Christians should have, that goodness comes from above through us and outward, as opposed to the goodness comes from this world and upward. You know, once I got my mind right about that, I understood. But before I was a Christian and I was trying to help people, like one scene, we'd be at a fire and imagine it's 11 o'clock or 2 a.m. or any time, and there's four of you and you pull up in front of a house and it's just raging inferno, locked gates. There's locks on the front doors. There's barred windows, but there's people yelling and screaming that you need to save the lives of the people in there.
Yeah.
Well, people see a fire truck as this mystical sort of thing with just superheroes on it.
Right.
They're just guys and gals like me. That's it, man. Wearing protective clothing that are highly skilled with a certain set of tools and know how to fight some fire. But it is still a horrible feeling when you get there too late. And so as a non-Christian, I was told my whole life, you can do whatever you want to do, be whatever you want to be, all this stuff. Well, if that was the case, then I would show up and every person that was trapped in a fire, I would pull them out and resuscitate them. They'd live because that's what I wanted for them. So in my mind, I was thinking I was becoming a big failure because we kick out one particular fire, you know, we kick open the door. And when you go into a fire, it is nothing like you see on TV or like a movie. You have a small space about 3 feet to work in. And in that space, you're still pushing, you know, anywhere from 300 to 500 degrees. Mm. Above that, you have 1200 degrees of heat. You got to crawl under that. Mm. Well, people say, why don't you shoot water through the window? Well, if we do, we'll create steam and we'll send that 1200 degrees down on the people and whoever may be in a pocket of air that's safe where they could live, we could take that away from them and kill them. Mm. So we have to crawl through all of that and get right under the flames because the flames may have to be in the back of the house, but that 1200 degrees is still coming out the front door. So you have to climb under that and get as much water as quickly as you can to the seat of the fire. So that's why we go interior and climb through all the stuff we go to. And as you're going, carpet's melting to you. And it's a crazy situation and you see nothing. Your flashlight doesn't even work.
Yeah.
The way I describe a fire is put both your hands over your eyes and that's what we see. Now add to it that you're in an environment that you're in someone's house that you've never been into. So you don't know if you're under a kitchen table or if you're running into stuff, you know, cause you're crawling. Well, in this particular fire, they were screaming that a mother and her daughter were trapped. Mm. And when we finally made it, pushed the flames down enough and were able to get to the mom and the child, we run out to the front door. Well, I still couldn't see. And I remember a captain stopped me and I knew his look that she had been burning as long as everything in that room and she didn't make it. So put her down and mom comes out. My buddy grabs mom and we thought we were going to rescue her and we're going to stop being firefighters and start becoming our paramedic side. And we couldn't. And I'd been to multiple fatality fires, but for whatever reason, that one affected me. Mm. It crushed me to my soul, because what you have to do then is, as a paramedic, I still have to declare them dead. Mm. And people don't realize to do that, I have to do an assessment as if I came up to you sitting here right now and said, "Hi, sir, how are you?" And checking your airway, breathing, circulation, see where you're. Well, you have to do that with them. So I have to do a full head to toe, turn them over, put the electrodes on them. And you can imagine what 1200 degrees does to a person for that. And again, for whatever reason, this was affecting me when the other fires didn't. So we get back to the firehouse, and I remember all I wanted was a handful of Tylenol and a cup of coffee and a shower. But we had a pastor waiting for us, and that pastor goes, "Hey, Jason, how are you?" Well, how do you think I was? Yeah. You know, and I just lit into that guy and started going, "You know what, dude, if you want to do some good for some people, why don't you put down that little fake book you carry around and grab a helmet and a coat and show up with us, and maybe you could actually help save a life." And I'm yelling, and my captain comes, "Oh, whoa, you know, slow your roll, man, you know." And I'm, you know, I was getting his face. And so my cap, he goes, "Hey, man, just go grab a shower real quick." But he said, the conversation they had, he said loud enough so I could hear. And I remember him saying, "Hey, pastor, I'm sorry for what Jason went through, but he just, you know, he doesn't have a place to leave all this stuff. Yeah. He's going up, but he's a firefighter that you want with you." And looking back at it now is one of the biggest moments of teaching grace that I can look at, because that pastor who I screamed at said it was my fault. He's all, "I shouldn't have approached Jason like that. And I'm really sorry. I shouldn't have done that." So here I am screaming and yelling, angry, and someone's being nice to me, and I didn't deserve that niceness.
Wow.
So things like that happen. So I would pick up that you would go to another call, and just seeing the loss of life, man, is so tough, you know, and West Oakland, where I was stationed, is beautiful. The people are beautiful. Everything is awesome, but there's some broken systems in this world. And I can't preach into all of them. All I can do is tell people about the one who can fix them, because there's just, I'd have to pick or choose which one I want to go with. Right. So instead I say, "Man, dude, yes, the system is broken. Yes, there is a reason I've held countless young black men who have been shot, and I don't know what it is. I have a pretty good idea, but the way I can fix this is by bringing in his love." But even when you preach that, think about that. You're holding people as they're dying.
Yeah.
And then their family members, they're screaming, "Save them." Mm. And all that pressure is on you. And when you don't have a place to leave that, it just starts weighing you down and down. And that's why, you know, I love my cops, my firemen, you know, firewomen. I love them, because I see the good that they're doing.
Yeah.
And I see the traumas. And obviously some people do bad things. That's really awful. And it does bother me. But when you're a first responder and you're taking on the evilness of this world manifested in such horrible ways, it's hard, even as a Christian. But imagine as a Christian when you can't explain where this evilness is coming from.
Right, right.
I'm not justifying. I'm not saying, "Oh, it's sin. So sin took that guy's life." I mean, but at least I have clarity.
Yeah.
And I now have a way to pray and ask for change and try to make a difference in the people who are being hurt, and also with myself who was hurt, you know?
Yeah.
And so that was the stuff that was weighing me down as it was leading up to me thinking about taking my life, compounded with my childhood, you know, the rough part of my childhood. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm interrupting this important conversation for a really good reason. We want to make sure you know about all of the resources that are available to you, our Nothing Is Wasted community. If you haven't heard us talk about it before, we have created a program that we want to make as value-adding as possible to your healing journey. Beyond the inspiration we all receive from our incredible conversations with our podcast guests, we also want to make sure we are taking it a step further by encouraging transformation. One way we do this is with our monthly partner program. By making a recurring monthly tax-deductible donation to our monthly partner program, anyone can access resource-driven content that goes above and beyond our normal conversations. For a $20 a month donation to Nothing Is Wasted Ministries, you can access monthly mini bonus episodes with past guests, full bonus episodes with new guests, 5 to 10 minute supplementary commentaries about each episode, live Q&As, Get first access to Nothing Is Wasted announcements, discounts to Nothing Is Wasted coaching, events and products, and other bonus content we'll release periodically. We want your support to this ministry to be mutually beneficial. So please take advantage of these resources as you consider setting up this partnership with us. To find out more information about this program, sign up, or try a free 7-day trial, head over to nothingiswasted.com/partners. Again, that's nothingiswasted.com/partners. Now back to our interview. How prevalent, Jason, is mental illness or suicide ideation in the field that you're working in, within all the first responder,
right,
within all the first responding fields? Because we talk a lot about like veterans, you know, coming back from mm-hmm. war and all the trauma that they experience, everything they see. And we're very aware and heightened to that. But before this conversation, honestly, I hadn't put a whole lot of thought into the same thing being true for first responders. And so can you enlighten us to that a little bit? How prevalent is mental illness in first responders situations?
You know, I can't speak into it from a way backed up with studies and what the statistics are. And honestly, I don't take that approach because I've witnessed so much from personally working along paramedics where someone will say, hey, did you hear so-and-so they killed themselves? Like, what? No way. Dude, I worked with that guy 20 years ago. Or, hey, did you hear so-and-so got in trouble for drugs? Like, no way, you know? And so, and so it comes from that aspect. The way that I look at it is, I mean, I'm talking to a man, you, who's gone through traumas that are just horrible and hideous that I haven't experienced. All pain is the same if you really think about it, but the person who's feeling it at the moment is the one that's hurting. Mm. And so as a first responder, when you're showing up and trying to alleviate that pain, it's hard because you can't tell other people that you're hurting. So you just have to kind of absorb it over time. So it just, as you can see, builds up. So with first responders, you know, it is tough for them because if you think about it, the going out partying and drinking and doing all that stuff is the way that they'll handle it a lot of times, especially the younger guys and gals. Usually when the older, more senior people come into play, they'll try to stop that. Obviously, Christians, you know, they got the Christian firefighters and that where they won't go that route. But even guys who I know are Christians have taken their lives. And it's just, you know, all I can say is the compounding of everything they've been to. Yeah. Plus, when you speak into mental illness, my take on it is we all have broken brains.
Right.
It's just everyone maybe at a different level of brokenness or shown a different way, because where maybe I suffer from depression or anxiety, but I can cope with it.
Yeah.
Why? I don't know. I can. And I praise God for it. Where someone else needs a little more help with it and stuff. So I think the problem being is with first responders, and I can't speak in the military side, is you're trained to be a tough guy. Mm. You're trained to handle it. Just handle it. Suck it up. Deal with it. Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
Right. That's like telling someone, Jesus loves you, and then walks away.
Right.
Okay, thanks. Right. You know, so I think it's the it's a culture, but I also think people that are drawn to this line of work also have something that makes them want to go there to help people because maybe they've experienced some of the past. So there's probably some deep rooted stressors from their past in there too, might be my guess.
Yeah, that's good. That's probably true. Very true. I love the thing that you've continually said as you've been explaining these situations, that you didn't have anywhere to put that pain. You just kind of had to absorb it as you're experiencing situation after situation after situation, where in some situations you get there too late, or there's fatality, or, you know, someone's dying in your arms. You didn't have anywhere to put that. But your story continues, and you go out to breakfast with this atheist, you walk away from this church that, right? So where then, what happens next as you're, you know?
So what happened next was I started looking at each thing a little different. And every call I went on, instead of recognizing the like horribleness, I started recognizing like I was showing empathy for them in a way of like, wow, I've gone through what they've gone through. And I don't want to end up like this. And one story that I write about is a gentleman who loses his life in a fire. And the backstory of it was he was living in his basement and he was in a three-story Victorian house and the upper floors of his house were beautiful, but his wife and his daughter had left him years before because of his alcoholism and some other stuff was what we heard from the neighbors. And he couldn't bear to go into that house anymore, the upper floors where he raised his family. So he moved into the basement, kind of made a little apartment down there. And he was the nicest guy. I mean, everyone told how he'd mow lawns, help out, everything, greatest guy in the world. But when we went in there, we pushed our way through the fire and we were just taking a beating trying to get to this guy and hoping that we could get to him before the flames got him, which we didn't. And we get in that room. I just remember seeing like, and I'm not judging the guy, but a few beer cans laying around and what looked like it was a TV and him alone on the bed. And also I went, I don't want to die alone. I don't want to die. I don't, there's something more to this, you know? Yeah. And another thing that happened shortly thereafter is I do CPR on a daily basis. It's just, you know, when people pass away or something bad happens, we get called and we try to give them all we got. And if we can't revive them, well, then we put the yellow blanket on them and we do what's next. Well, this one gentleman, we show up and he had been married to his wife for almost 70 years. And he went and took a nap and his wife went to wake him from his nap and she couldn't wake him up. So she calls us and we show up on scene and we find him, check his pulse. And sure enough, you know, his pulse is, so we gently take him onto the floor because that's where that's our hospital bed is the floor. And so we do that. We cut his clothes off and we start doing everything we have to do to resuscitate him, start IVs, put a breathing tube down in him, send electricity through his heart if need. And as we're doing all this, I go up to the front room because I just want to talk to the wife real quick. And when I was going down this hallway, I almost call it the hallway of love. I just see generations of pictures with these two of like the head of the family. And you can just feel the love radiating out of those pictures, right? And so I get to the front room and I remember this sweet little lady, could have been but 5'4" at the most and 100 pounds, was holding this old vintage King James Bible just clutched to her chest like it's all she had in life. Wow. And all I wanted to do was ask her a couple quick medical questions. What type of medicine to take? Da, da, da. And so I could kind of put together what had happened to this gentleman. So I get that. And she asked me, how's my love? And I said, well, we're still trying, but his heart's not beating. He's not breathing. Because I wanted to let her know the seriousness of what we're dealing with. So I go back down the hallway and we give a few more rounds of medications and finally say, all right, guys, I tell the crew it's time to stop CPR. Well, we wanted to redress this guy, and so we put a new shirt on him. We buttoned it back up. I remember getting his hair right, and we put him back into bed, and we took all our medical stuff off him because I didn't want the last memory that his wife had of him to be of a medical patient. I wanted him to look like the way she came in and saw him when he was taking a nap. So you do that, and as I go walking down the hallway, my throat is lumped up, and I'm talking 6'1", 220, fireman, paramedic. And I'm feeling tears. I've never felt this. And as I go down, she just looks at me and she goes, my love is with Jesus, right? Well, I didn't believe in Jesus, but of course I'm going to say yes, you know, because that's my job and I want to bring her some care, but I'm bringing it. I have tears. Well, she puts down that Bible, straightens it out, and she puts her arms wide out. She wraps them around me and she's all, it's okay, sweetheart. My love is with Jesus. And in my mind, I'm like, no way. She just lost 7 years of her life. And she's again showing me grace. And there was a Bible involved, just like the pastor was. And so things started to think, I'm like, it felt good. I wanted that hug to last forever. And stuff, because here I was, tough guy, trying to give her grace.
Yeah.
And she's pouring it out on me.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. And so to speed up the story there a little, I was one night going out to dinner with my niece who would come and visit me for the summers. And she wanted to go to this Mexican restaurant that we would go to. And it was right in downtown Santa Rosa where all the kids hung out, the college kids and stuff. So we go there and I remember seeing this waitress there and it wasn't like a, whoa, and a light shined over her, but she had this glow about her. There was something so different about this waitress that I stumbled with my words. And as you can see from here, I have a lot of words. but I had none for it. And she comes over to our table, she's like, can I take your order? And I was like, and everything. And she did. And I ended up getting her phone number. And she actually gave me a fake phone number at first. And I called her out on it because I could see, I'm like, wait, this is scratched down. I'm good at investigating. So she gives me the right phone number. And we go out on a couple dates. And I fell in love with her. Mm. And I've never fallen in love, and I've had long-term relationships in the past, but I've always destroyed every relationship I've ever been in, or let the darkness inside me eat it up. And I've actually hurt a lot of people. I really feel bad, you know, for hurting. But with her, she had something different. And I remember one day as we were talking, she asked me about my faith, because I had another rough call where a young girl was hit by a car and she lost her life. And I was holding her, and her mom was in the street with me, and her mom was grieving, and I didn't want to let her daughter go because her daughter was really kind of torn up from the hit and run that she was involved in, and she's only 6 years old. Jeez. And I was telling Christy about this, and Christy's like crying, and I'm like, why are you crying? And I'm like, oh great, Jason, you messed up again, you know, here you go, you messed it up, you're gonna ruin it again. You let your filter off, because I would never let my filter off, because when I told them how rough my job was, they couldn't handle it. And so she has tears in her eyes. I'm like, I'm sorry for making you cry. She's like, no, I'm sorry for the pain that you went through. I'm like, you're crying over my pain? And she's all, but at least that little girl's with Jesus, right? And I didn't have an answer for her. I'm like, whoa, I don't have an answer for you. Well, she says after that, she's like, hey, I want to see you tonight after I get off work. She's a college student and she worked a couple of jobs. I mean, she was a worker. Wow. And so in my mind, I'm like, great, she's going to dump me because she asked me, do you believe in Jesus? I don't have an answer for you. All this other stuff. I'm like, I'm wrestling. So I go down and I buy a Bible, and I have about 10 hours to go find myself some Jesus before I go and meet with Christy. And I think I got to Deuteronomy. There was no Jesus anywhere in that Bible, man. And all I was reading was Shakespearean Bible too. I'm like, what is it? This and all this. I'm like, my goodness. So that night, I end up meeting her, and I'm like, you know what? Forget this. Should I dump her first? How should I handle this? But my mind said, something kept telling me, no, just go. So she sits down with me at 10 o'clock at night, and she just starts tears in her eyes again. Mm. She's like, I'm in love with you. I'm like, and she's all, but I love you so much, I'm not going to keep dating you unless you come to church with me. Mm. And everyone's like, so what happened? Like, well, she was hot, so I went to church with her. Let's keep it real. But there was also way more to it. Okay. Yeah, there's way more to it. And when I went to church with her, it wasn't, church didn't save me, but believe it or not, I met a pastor who gave me the unabridged gospel of Jesus Christ. Mm. And it actually offended me to my bitter, like, what? I'm not good. No, I'm a fireman, and I'm doing good. And he's like, where's your goodness coming from? And he came at me in a real good, loving, caring way.
Yeah.
But he could also see my fireman side needed that kind of like a little nudge. Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying to approach everyone the same,
right.
But he could assess the way that I need to assess. And shortly thereafter, it's like, all right, I'm in. Let's go, Jesus. Let's do this.
Wow.
You know, and it's not like people are like, all right, so everything is better. I'm like, no, life still sucks. Let me tell you about it. Okay. Worse, I'm still in the same pain machine that we call the fallen world that you are, and it hurts and it beats me up. But now I have clarity. But more importantly, I have hope. Mm-hmm. I have something to hang on to. So when we're going through the trials, like you know what you've gone through and what so many other people have gone through that probably listen to this podcast, and the pain that they're feeling. At the moment, I don't show up and say, hey, God's going to find glory out of this and all that, because that's a hideous way to approach it.
Yeah.
But I can bring glory to him by just loving on them at the moment, giving them whatever they need, which more times than not may be listening.
Yeah.
And leaving them with some hope.
Right.
And when you hang on to that hope and Jesus is in the mix, time doesn't heal anything, but time with Jesus will heal everything. Mm. And that's just kind of what becoming a follower of Christ has done for me, you know, because I still hurt. My childhood still hurts. A lot of this stuff still hurts, but I now use it to try to find ways to glorify God. And how can I glorify God is by using my stories to help other people.
That's great. Yeah. I love that, you know, you approach a situation where you recognize there's some intense pain. You're responding to a situation in whatever way you're responding. And instead of using your words to say, hey, God's going to be glorified out of this, because you're right, that's unbelievably insensitive in that moment to anybody who's going through something difficult. You instead become Jesus with flesh on, right? Like you become the best manifestation of Jesus. Isn't that what Christian means? Little Christ. We are a representation of Jesus right here in the here and now in 2020. And you do exactly what that little 5 foot nothing lady did to you, and just wrap her arms around you and be that hope.
Right.
Demonstrate it. I love that. That's amazing. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's 1 Corinthians 16:14. Let all that you do be done in love.
That's it.
Well, where does love come from? Then let's go back to the greatest commandment, love him.
Yeah.
And then love your neighbor, you know? And it's like, let it all be done in love, but don't do it in a way that I want to make it better.
Yeah.
I want to make it better because I want them to feel the love that's been poured into me, and I want it to pour out of me into other people.
Can you speak to, you know, after your conversion, after you experienced this, you know, rich love of Jesus, how did that change then the way that you approached pain, your own pain, other people's pain? How did you begin to be able to absorb those things differently?
Definitely. So, you know, we'll hear, where do you leave it? And so what I say by that is, you're leaving it by now having a way to deal with it. You know, it's not like I close my eyes and Jesus just magically appears, grabs it out of me, and off it's gone. Right. But I can go to the words breathed out by God himself to find what I need to fit that situation.
Yeah.
And when I don't, then I just go to the word and say, all right, well, I could come to someone like you and say, hey, this is what I'm struggling with. So now I have a brotherhood and a sisterhood I can go to. So there is a place to leave it because I'm not holding it in. I'm releasing it outward, you know? And so I'm always cautious to say, because again, if I say, well, just leave it at the foot of the cross, people are like, okay. Thanks, pal.
Do I go to a church? Is there actually a cross? Do I take my shirt off? What does that mean?
Yeah. People like, you know, I'm like, well, I felt better. I gave them some great advice that I heard on a podcast, you know, but becoming a Christian, you know, and obviously when you first start out, I didn't get it all. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'll be honest with you. I know for a fact that I was saved, but I'm looking at this story of Jonah like, oh, really? 3 days in a whale? Because I'm still in the flesh and I'm growing, right?
Yeah.
But then I flop it around and say, imagine if I came and said, hey, Davey, dude, I'm all in for the 3 days in the whale thing, but that guy who died for my sins on the cross, I don't know if I buy into that yet. Mm-hmm. You know, no, it's all the truth. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of times, when you're pouring into people, what I try to do is look at where their walk is. Because if someone tried to talk to me as I'm brand new in Christ, as if I've been 20 years in them, I don't have that huge timeline that they have.
Right.
And so as a Christian, what I try to do is I come at people and I think, like, sometimes just like get into the Psalms or something. Mm-hmm. Wow. You know, just number one for yourself, you'd be like, man, your word is a lamp to my feet and a light to my path.
Yeah.
Okay. Who's in my path that I can now let that light project on, because I lived in the dark. And when I bring that light to someone else, now I'm helping them, but I'm also releasing all the baggage, because I'm doing, it's like I'm working for God now, not working for Jason anymore.
Yeah.
And as a firefighter, that made sense, because I still went to the stuff that so many of your listeners have dealt with.
Yeah.
And it's horrible. I mean, to sit there and have people beg you to save their loved one, yeah, and you can't, it would tear me apart. Yeah. But I wouldn't let me tear me apart, because then I would try to leave them with a bit of love.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And the hope that they need. And I mean, unless we went incident by incident, I could give you 1,000 different ways of what it looked like.
Yeah.
What that love looked like.
Well, you know, I can say from my story, and my experience, that there are distinct memories that I have in, you know, the 2 months or so immediately following after, you know, my wife's death, even in those moments where first responders were responding to our situation. But the interactions I had with other first responders and other responders within that situation, that I could tell who in those situations had the love of Jesus in them, and who just kind of saw it as a job.
Right.
I mean, it was very, very clear to me, Jason, like, you know, I'd interact with somebody and it's like, wow, that person, that paramedic, that, you know, officer, whatever it was, they just ministered to me more than a pastor could.
Right.
Right there.
Right.
By what they just said to me, demonstrated to me, you know, so how they served me. Whereas there was, you know, others who just kind of saw it as like, yeah, this is business as usual. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure they felt the pain of it. I'm sure it affected them. They just didn't know where to place it exactly, as you said, you know?
Yeah. It's a balance you have to take, because obviously on scene we have A, B, C, D, E, F, and G that we have to, what I sometimes explain to is the way we show by grace is by being stone cold lifesavers.
Yeah.
When you're putting, you know, a large bore IV into someone's jugular vein, it doesn't feel very good. And the care that you're going to give them is actually going to hurt them a lot.
Right.
And sometimes you have to take a psychological approach, if you will, to be that stone cold. But like you said, though, there is always a time to give that bit of grace. And you can see when people don't give that grace.
Yeah.
And you have to. And examples that I give like that is being a firefighter in Oakland, which truly is one of the most diverse cities in the world, because we have people from all over the world that come there as refugees. And so like after the Afghanistan war started, we had a lot of folks that moved into our district. And I would be looking at a Muslim in a burqa and people say, well, she's an American, treat her this way. No, hold on, you guys. We're only here for 3 or 4 minutes. We can cause some problems if we do things the American way. Or say like this, you're over in a part of town and you have maybe some family here from China and they lost their child. And in your mind, you're thinking, why are they not crying? Well, check this out. Culturally, they have been maybe taught, and I'm not wanting to speak too far into it, but I've just witnessed so many times, they're not crying and they shut down quietly. But then we go to this side over the town where it's maybe more of what I call a Pentecostal way of showing your sadness, where your there's emotion. The yelling and the screaming. And people like say, oh, why are they acting like that? Well, I'm thinking back, how would you act if your child was killed? If something happened with my child, I would kind of shut down and people look like I'm very angry, you know, because I'm, you know, and stuff.
Right.
But guess what? That family, that nice Chinese family I just talked about, they were feeling pain. The person wailing and flopping on the ground, they're feeling the same pain and I'm feeling the same pain. But it's how we show empathy care is what makes the difference there.
That's so true. That's so great. I think that's what, you know, experiencing the love of Jesus, having that fill us up, that allows us to have the capacity to approach situations and look at people as people. You know,
I agree with that so much, because you know, it's like, let's just take some stuff today and they'll slide away from it. As a Christian, I can't stand injustice. I can't stand someone created in his likeness not being treated properly.
Yeah.
It disgusts me. It's such a sinful, broken system. But once you become a Christian, it makes sense. Whereas a non-Christian, you go, oh, yeah, it's kind of messed up that's happening. I don't know why it's happening. You know, now I can say it crushes me that it's happening.
Right.
And it crushes me that people are hurt, whether they've gone through a major traumatic experience or this world's just kicking them down like it used to kick me down, or still does kick me down. But before I became a Christian, when it kicked me down, I looked at it different, you know. But once you get the love of Christ, like, oh my gosh, there's so much more. And sometimes, as you probably can experience this, it becomes stressful because you just want everyone to accept it. You know,
exactly.
You're like, I want you to get the love is here. Come grab it. You know,
right.
And like, you're not the Holy Spirit, Jason. Settle down.
Well, it's just, it's a weird upside down kingdom that we now operate in, you know, as believers. It doesn't make sense to someone who's not a believer, but you take, you know, what you've already been talking about, some of these broken systems, systemic injustices in our world. And there was systemic injustice with God's people when Jesus entered the earth, and they all interpreted that Jesus was going to be a political leader that was going to crush that injustice, right? But what did he do? He did something completely upside down, and he just walked out this story of love, forgiveness, grace, and servitude, and then laid down his life.
Right.
And that was his response.
Yes.
To injustice.
Let's hit that. Like, John 15:13, you know, greater love has no one this, that someone lay down his life for his friends. Well, obviously I'm not talking about me going around in propitiation, if you will, you know, we're talking about me laying my life down so others can make it into the kingdom of heaven, paying the price for sins. But my wife, here's a great example. She lays her life down by she stops being a mom. Mm-hmm. If you think about it, a wife, when she goes to work to deliver babies and love on moms and new families and stuff. So I look at it that if we all learn to lay our life down in a way to love on others, change happens, man.
Yeah, that's it.
And that's just something that I always fall back on is John 15:13, because we love to say, oh, a fireman, John 15:13, he's going to die for someone. Well, I get it. Yes, I would die for someone if I had to. But if we all die every day to take care of other people, I don't know what it looks like, but I think we could all look into our lives and find a way to do that.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. So, you know, Jason, you mentioned at the beginning of this podcast that you've made quite a transition, you know, 5 years ago. It was a difficult transition for you. You got injured.
Yeah.
And so you had to step away from actually being on the front lines. Tell me a little bit about that transition and now kind of what you're doing. What has God taught you in that?
Well, you know, what's funny is I was telling God no for so long. So I wish I had a great fire department story to tell you about my injury, but I got injured in a fire where I fell through a floor, and it wasn't very traumatic because first off, there's so many firefighters in this great nation of ours who have gone through way more than I have and are in wheelchairs and severe burns. So my thing is absolutely nothing, but because I had to get my back rebuilt, my hips fixed and stuff, I couldn't continue on as a firefighter anymore.
Wow.
But after my first injury, I kept going back to work, and I hurt and I hurt and I hurt, and it was killing me and stuff. And finally, one day we're just, you know, doing a little yard work around the fire aisles, and bam, the surgery I had let out, you know, all the hardware they put into me. And that was the day I couldn't be a firefighter anymore.
Wow.
And I remember when the doctor came into the room to me after, and this was a few months after the incident, obviously, and he says, Jason, you're medically retiring from the fire department. Retirement's not in my DNA. I'm like, what? And I yelled at him. I said, I hopped off the table and I got in the elevator, and he follows me to the elevator, and you're talking full-fledged Christian, professing, writing, talking to churches. I looked that doctor in the face, said, don't get in this elevator with me. It's not going to end well for you. I mean, that's how broken I was. I mean, I was like, it was out. But then when I started looking at what had happened, obviously I apologized to the doctor. It was such a beautiful thing that happened because I was still idolizing my job. Even as a Christian of many years, I'm a firefighter. It's what made me who I am. It's what's going to feed my family. It's what brings me happiness and joy, right? Even though I'm preaching that it comes from God.
Yeah.
And so God started opening up my eyes, and that's when I just started writing a little bit. I started just kind of going to Facebook because I don't know technology as I wish the listeners could hear at the start of this podcast, trying to figure out how to put earphones on. So I go to Facebook and I just started writing about my experiences. And then, you know, a couple of pastors I'm friends with, like, you need to tell your story in just not little blog forms. You need to put it more together in a book form. And I brushed that off. But the way that these past few years have been just amazing is being able to speak at men's retreats. People contact me. Like, one story is about 2 days before I finally made the decision and signed the paper that, yeah, I was going to write a book and have it published. I really didn't know if I'd do it. And I got a message through Facebook, of all places, from a firefighter back east. And he said, I'm going to kill myself tomorrow. Well,
wow.
I'm trying to deal with that. So I don't want anyone to take this story a certain way. So I immediately give my phone number, which I'm kind of cautious to, you know, with the internet stuff, but I could see it. And the first thing I told him, I said, first off, I know you're a firefighter or a firefighter, so you're scared to give me your name, so I'm going to send people out to you right now and put you on a hold. I'm not going to do that. I said, also, if you do something tomorrow, I'm not going to feel guilty. So we're going to start right there, because I'm talking brother on brother. Right. So I knew how to come at him in a certain way. I said, what's up, dude? And he told me, I listened. And then I told him my story. And We still talk to this day.
Wow.
And that's when I signed the thing. Not that I didn't write a book just for firefighters, because my book is for everyone. Right, it's about, we're in dark times right now, but if God can, quote, save the wretch like me, it's for, he can save anyone. But it also, if he keeps giving me that hope to hang on to, that hope's available for anyone.
Yeah.
Well, it was kind of cool to give that guy some hope, you know? And shortly, maybe a few months thereafter, he sends me this thing of, Romans in it, I'm saved. And I'm like, what's he writing here? And I'm like, oh, okay. He professed with it. Wow. Okay, I get it now. You know, and so I text him back. I said, bro, I already knew that you were saved. It's okay. You know? So that's what my life has been, is every day I get over 200 emails and messages from people. And I can't pour into all of them the way I wish I could. But what I do is I direct them to their local churches, sound churches and stuff. Wow. So that's what my past few years have looked like. And besides that, when Christy lets me, I go out and do a lot of surfing.
Yeah. Well, you're getting to be a first responder in a different way, spiritually.
Totally.
And emotionally. And it's really cool to see, you know, even in that transition, as tough as it is, how God's showing up in that and bringing a lot of joy into your life by doing it, you know?
Yeah.
Life happens in seasons, and sometimes he dries up those, you know, dries up that creek bed like he did for Elijah, but it's always to transition us to something else, that he's another type of ministry, another sector that he has for us. And
exactly. And that's, you know, I fall back on Isaiah 55:8-9, you know, about his thoughts are not our thoughts and our ways are not his ways. But then I take it down to the simplest thing, is he is so perfect. He is so amazing. Yeah. And so I reflect then back on that verse about how his utter perfection is taking care of me, and his ways are so good, you know, because when you take the trauma of my childhood and the trauma, everything leading up to me almost wanting to kill myself, and then even the traumas after there, about how he weaved them into a way that I can now help others. It's just so awesome.
Yeah, man, such a great story of redemption. And this has been, I've just thoroughly enjoyed this conversation, Jason. It's been really great to hear your heart and to hear, I can tell you're going to have a massive impact. And, I know that you just released this book, and it's going to just have a really, really cool ripple effect into so many different people's lives. And so if you're listening to this, you want to make sure that you pick it up, called The Rescuer by Jason Sawtelle. And, Jason, where can we kind of follow the stuff that you're doing? You have a website, you have a place that we can keep track of you?
You know, I have a website, but you know, I'm an old fuddy-duddy, so I can't figure out a lot of stuff. And I know, being 45, she isn't that old, but you know, Facebook is where I'll do a lot of this stuff. It's Jesus Is All We Need by Jason Sawtelle, because that's the message I always try to come back to, no matter if it's in a book or anywhere else, is Jesus Is All We Need. So it's there. And then jasonsawtelle.com. And they also have a website called rescuerbook.com.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, man, thanks so much for spending time with us on this. This has just been great.
Oh, man, it's totally blessed me, and I really appreciate you. Thank you.
What a great conversation with Jason. Man.
So good.
He was, wow.
Yeah, he had so much wisdom, and I loved hearing what God has done in his life and now through other people because of his ministry. It's really awesome. If you liked that episode, if it meant something to you, or any of our other episodes, you can go on iTunes, you can read reviews, and you can actually rate us as well there. I have a review that I want to read here.
Oh, good.
It says this: I am in the training for trial stage of life, but I love listening to the stories of warriors who have endured so much adversity. Mm. Yet each of these individuals came out on the other side with grace and encouragement for others to listen in on. This podcast helps me keep my mind on a perspective other than this world.
Wow.
Thanks for your enlightening conversations. That's so good.
Wow.
Love that.
Wow. That's awesome. Man, thank you so much for whoever wrote that in. Mm-hmm. And we would love it if you would also rate and review, so we can hear your feedback on how this podcast is ministering to you. Also, we'd love for you to join the conversation. Follow us on Instagram at Nothing Is Wasted Ministries. You can follow me at Davey Blackburn. That's EY. by the way. Some people do IE. They think, I don't know, who spells her name?
IE for a boy. No.
Yeah, who does
that? It's EY.
Right? EY. And then you can follow Aubrey at AubSamp, AUBSAMP. And we want to thank Sleeping at Last for providing all the music for the Nothing Is Wasted podcast. Listen to his music anywhere music can be downloaded and streamed. And next week, we have a special treat for you because Aubrey, you are interviewing a guest on the Nothing Is Wasted podcast. This is your first interview other than interviewing me.
Other than interviewing you, right. Yes.
Which I don't feel like, I mean, I feel like that counts, but it doesn't count because...
It doesn't quite count. I hear what you're saying.
Yeah, yeah, you understand. Yeah. I mean, it definitely counts. You did a great job interviewing me, but...
Well, thank you.
This is one where you're interviewing one of our guests, which is fantastic. Yeah. She happens to be a friend of yours, Ashley Island.
Yes.
And we talked about several weeks ago when we did our interview with Sheila Wise Rowe. We talked about some of the things that you and your family and your church are doing strategically to continue the conversation about racial reconciliation. And right. This is going to be another one of those continuing conversations that we have. So I know that the listener is going to be really excited to hear you jump in and kind of do all this. I'm excited that you're jumping in and doing some interviewing. And I know you guys cannot wait to hear what Aubrey pulls out in this conversation. And so why don't we go ahead and listen to a clip from her conversation with Ashley Island.
I don't know that a lot of folks would expect a Black woman right now to speak to unity in a time like this.
Yeah.
Because we've earned the scars to not have to.
You have. That's right.
Just as a people, as Black people, I fully understand my brothers and sisters who don't have it right now to say, let's unify.
Right.
I get right. that.
Right.
And I feel that some days.
Yeah.
But I think the message that isn't really mine, I feel like it's God's message, is that I am preaching both the pain, going back to what we talked about before, mm-hmm. both the pain and the hope.
Yeah.
Both saying, nope, to actually love me as your Black sister, you need to sit in this with me.
Yeah.
I'm inviting you to sit in what's so hard and tense and all the tomfoolery happening around right. that may not impact you, but is what makes me stay up until 2 o'clock in the morning. Like, I'm inviting you into that.
Yeah.
And I can make space. Let's make space for that kind of love and yeah. that kind of empathy and that kind of unity in the spirit, right?
Yeah.
But I'm also calling people higher.